morose. But this is our protective armor. They said it was filled with down, but it's filled with metta. It's our conscious, very conscious defenses. Intentional. Brahma, sublime, divine, whatever that may mean to you, and Vihara, abode, dwelling, home, the heart. The dwelling or abiding in these divine and sublime emotions, pure emotion, the purest kind of emotion. I think all other emotions eventuate in these four primary spiritual emotions, which I experience as just at times when they are matured in practice, just very subtle and pure, pervasive, all-encompassing emotion. And in time you'll come to know why they also call them the four immeasurables. Because they can't be measured, or the boundless states, because there's no end, no end to the extent with which they can expand. If we put the Vipassana wisdom practice side by side with the metta concentration practice, we can see areas where they directly have the same aim. You know, although concentration practice is, as Michelle was talking about, to bring the tranquility, one-pointedness of mind, and with the pure concentration, or samatha, it's called, and Vipassana wisdom uses, whereas the samatha uses fixed concentration, Vipassana uses a fluid or momentary concentration, as she said last night. They have the same aim in removing the illusionary sense of a separate self. I, me, mine. Vipassana is through dismantling the constructed sense of a separate I, me, mine. We see the combination flow of bodily experience, feelings, perceptions, emotions and intentions, and the knowing mind itself. And we see how they come together to create what we really are, this process, this living, alive stream of momentary events. Whereas in the metta practices, it does the same thing through that immeasurability, that expansion. So vast the heart becomes to the endless reaches of the universe, there's no room. There's no space for a separate, solid I, me, mine, separate self. Through expansion, or through seeing the component parts, concentration, wisdom. And of course, in both cases, it's that selfless sense of ourself as a process. So it's the metta that mettas, you know, the love that loves, the compassion that cares, the empathetic joy that joys. Doesn't, no subject object, as Michelle was also saying last night. And the equanimity, the balance that balances these emotional qualities, innate, we already have them. We're practicing merely to begin to unlayer, unstack, unpeel all the sort of unconscious defenses we've acquired, accumulated through habit, through need. You know, as we've been saying, the little person wisdom we had that just knew how to survive and protect herself, you know, or we wouldn't be here now. Certainly not in the way that we can be here. Been talking about using these terms I'll speak to tonight, you know, abiding, receiving, sending. I think of this this hero of mine who passed away a few years ago, a man, indigenous man from Micronesia, who was really the only person left on Earth who knew how to sail without any instrumentation in the ancient ways, so several thousand years of double hull, deep water canoe voyages. And in 1975, a group of friends, three or four friends, three of whom were my friends from childhood, high school, university, formed this Polynesian Voyaging Society. And one was this Hawaiian artist, and a native Hawaiian speaker who knew the language and the lore. And he reconstructed, first with drawings, what a double hull sailing canoe looked like. And then again, from the legends, the lores, the chants, what it was made of and how it was sailed, and bit by bit, they put these component parts together to make this like a living entity that could sail. And a couple of years later, they did. They sailed from Hawaii to Tahiti with Mao Pialug from Micronesia, being the neat lead navigator and beginning to teach this young man, also a friend of mine, Nainoa Thompson, to be the first Hawaiian in 600 years to relearn the art of non-instrument navigation through attunement, through the senses, using all the five physical senses and the sixth sense of intuition, mind, door, intuition, to read all the signs, all the movements, currents, waves, vibrations, colors, scent, clouds, rain, stars, everything. They all were a map that could tell one at any time where they were in the universe. This is how Mao said he learned. When he was just a baby, like still pre-verbal age, maybe 15, 16 months, his grandfather, who was his teacher, would put him in tidal pools. You know, a pool of water on a shelf of lava. He was safe. But he could feel the movement of waves. So his body began to learn an earth language long before he learned a human language. Just the gravitational force. The Buddha said in many ways, you know, that we affect everyone and everything in the universe. And Newton said the same thing in his law of gravitational force, that each of us, and in fact every particle, affects every other being, every other particle in the universe. We come to understand that more viscerally and experientially through these practices, through their immeasurable nature, their relational nature, and their connective nature. To teach us that the connection has always been there. And the relational nature we have, the interrelated nature we have with ourselves and each other and all things of this earth and universe in ways that we've forgotten. You know, we're never taught. Or just lost touch with. Somewhere in there, we know it. That's why we're here and doing a retreat like this. So learning that from such a young age, and he taught him other things too that may sound cruel. But for example, when he was 14 and he was out navigating, by the time learning to navigate himself with his granddad in rough waters, he got seasick. He said, "Oh, my grandfather, he just tied a rope around me, threw me overboard. Dragged me along the canoe. I got over being seasick." I've never been seasick since. I don't know what that method is, but it worked with Mao because, you know, he was very tentative at first and had conditions in the passing of this knowledge. It was a sacred thing. It was a very sacred event, as was everything to do with the resurgence and renaissance of the awakening of Hawaiian and eventually Polynesian heritage, spirituality. So certain agreements were made about how he would teach, who he would teach, and what he required of the students learning, all young students at that time. And that at any time he felt it wasn't working, he would go home. You know, which he did once. And it took a lot to get him back. So in a way, we're sort of unlearning these sort of solidified senses of objects, you know, how the habit of objectifying things, including ourselves and our feelings and our emotions and our sense of being and other people. We hear it in our, if we listen, we hear it in our judgments. And eventually we feel it in the body, in the places where the body is tight or where we can't feel anything, where we've become numb, or where our sort of our character structure is rigid. And we don't immediately open that up. It's too radioactive. It's too tense and intense. And we take time. We just make space around it. And all these practices are about making space and moving incrementally, just in centimeters, moving ahead. There's no rush. There's nothing to get to. We're not going anywhere. Michelle taught the walking yesterday. We're just walking. It does really not take us anywhere except inside. And understanding, we walk until, as one of my Burmese monk teachers, when Sayadaw Upandita was away, he got me to walk by agreeing that if I walked for 2 weeks, according to the schedule, and didn't like it, I didn't have to walk anymore. So I said, "Oh, that's a good deal, you know. I'll walk, follow the schedule for 2 weeks, and I don't have to walk anymore." Of course, he knew he had me, you know. Within a week, I began of just walking, following the schedule. Hour sit, hour walk. If I sat a little longer, I would walk a little longer, and just did it. The kind and quality of concentration for from walking, it's different than from sitting and standing and lying, because it's meditation in motion. There's a fluidity to it, a nimbleness, flexibility, a pliancy, elasticity, that's crucial in moving our practice deeper inside to experiential levels. And the kind of energy from walking is, of course, different. We get energy from learning to sit and hold our posture reasonably well. I should let you know, because maybe we forgot to tell you, that the metta is a happiness practice. So unlike vipassana, you don't have to sit through pain. If you're feeling painful, move. Not to the degree of being fidgety and all that, but certainly move. Relieve that back pain or that knee pain. This is a happiness practice. You don't need to know about pain here. We'll know enough about it. But how to use the Brahmaviharas to address it instead of the dukkha right into the pain mindfulness that otherwise. So walking, the energy that's developed in the walking, again, is different from our postures because it merges, it interacts, it marries with the concentration. So that energetic, fluid concentration that we're gifted with at the end of a few days of real sincere walking, then we'll understand. We'll understand why we walk for no reason. So once I got it, he said another thing to me. He said lots of things, but a very meaningful thing. He just said, just walk until you're a complete stranger to yourself. So in the Vipassana wisdom, that means it's to walk until it's just elemental movement. Here, it's just walk into, which is, it's metta in motion. Movement of metta, compassion, empathetic joy, balance, the grace of balance back and forth. Fluid like the gravitational waves when Mao's in the pool. Learning the language, a primal language at such a young age that would guide him the rest of his life. This is a poem by A.R. Ammons called Stills. I have nowhere to go, and nowhere to go when I get back from there. That's why we're walking. In all of these practices here this week and next week, Vipassana, we're learning to do nothing with full commitment. Thus the abiding. Thus the abiding. And you will see soon that the abiding is receiving and sending. All we have to do is abide. The receiving and sending is nature. It just happens through the nature of abiding, resting, relaxing. There's a Pali, Buddhist Pali language term for it, viveka, generally means seclusion. Seclusion from what? From distraction. Interferences, particularly at first external interferences and then later internal. It also has another significant, deeper meaning, and that's rest. Rest or relaxation. when we really learn just a few moments at a time to genuinely rest, just let everything go, feel that dropping in sensation. I think I spoke of the first night, just completely relax. Everything happens on its own, and it does really feels experientially that we're doing nothing. So then you might ask, well, what about when we use the phrases and visualization? You know, that feels like doing. Yes, it can feel like doing, and to a degree we are. We're borrowing from our conceptual body of thoughts and intentions, and using them as like handles. In Burma, certain areas, there's these bamboo bridges that span a gorge or a river, and there's those, what do you call them, and they swing back and forth. You know, they're fragile. You look down and you don't want to be looking, you wish you hadn't looked down. And there's just little ropes on each side. And you just inch your way across. The phrases and the visualized or felt sense of our metta subject or focus is like that. We're just temporarily borrowing the concept of a visualized image, or using phrases as suggestions to drop into an emotional, pure emotional experience. And there's a way that we can do it that doesn't feel strained. It just feels like a tool of practice, just quite temporary. You know, our aim is to get across that bridge. And if your balance is really good, you know, maybe you don't need to hold on to those ropes, but sometimes it's really, really narrow and it's a swinging back and forth and you want to be holding on. Likewise, that's useful when the mind's being distracted. So if we're using a lot of thoughts, we use thoughts to replace those distracting thoughts, the hindering thoughts, hindering calm and the metta practice. So that's why we use them. That's why the phrases can be helpful. Just keep us in balance, keep us so we can cross that bridge and not be pulled by every instance. And when we do, we learn how to, say it's by pain or strong emotion, then either with the Vipassana labeling, fear, anxiety, grief can be helpful, or we can stay within the container of the Brahmavihara practice and just try to make metta bigger. Just try to make metta awareness bigger than that fear, that sadness, that grief or that anxiety. It is bigger, but it doesn't always feel that way. As it gets stronger, that's what it's for, because it directly opposes, denourishes its opposite, ill will, anger, aggression, fear. So we can borrow these handles, these the concepts that serve us to stay on track, with the sense, ultimately, of doing nothing. You know, and as the experience develops and grows, so does our faith and confidence and trust. Really, three terms of the same quality maturing. It's an initial faith to a greater kind of confidence until it's an unconditional trust in this Dhamma within, this practice within, this Brahma Vihara truth. universal love. So much that it just seems to take over. It picks us up and carries us. Yeah. That's what we have to look forward to. And for now, it's just inch by inch. It's incremental. Just, we're making little spaces and little advances. Not feeling, anytime we feel that we're pushing or rushing or striving to get somewhere, is when we, oh, I'm not relaxed. I'm not letting go. And just try to drop back within ourselves. So briefly, metta is tending to our connection with everything, with ourselves and everything, and our relational nature to ourself, everyone, and everything. It's tending to that. Karuna, the word for compassion, is tending to caring for what's difficult, tending to difficulty with compassion. Mudita, the term for empathetic joy, is tending to happiness, beauty, delight, fulfillment with joy. We're tenderers, we're tending to things. Upeka it means to look upon, the word for balance, equanimity, is tending to being balanced in the midst of things as they are, in the midst of what's called the eight worldly conditions, which we'll talk about when we get there, but they're like the opposites, pleasure, pain, praise, blame, that sort of thing. Being able to stay balanced when that's all that's happening, when experience, things that are happening that beyond our control, is pleasurable or painful. We can't control that, but we can be balanced with it. We can be non-reactive to it. Reactivity is the opposite of equanimity. So this tending to helps us understand, as I said, any one Brahma-vihara cultivates all of them. Both Michelle and I, when we started doing extensive periods of practice in the Brahma-viharas at Sayadaw Upandita, we stayed with like one metta subject for me, it was for like 3 weeks. Just get a little momentum going with myself and then like call up benefactor. That's all. Day in, day out, like 14 hours or something a day for 3 weeks before doing anything else. And that really helps sink it in. That really helps slow things down. Really? You know? Because it's not advancing to go all over the place and, you know, all the different categories, if we use that conceptual imagination, or feel that we're able to extend this expanse of metta, you know, around the earth and to the solar system and to all the planets, galaxies, and universes. It's all right here anyway. And what I say, what I've said, and again, I'll say, whatever we experience is inside. Light is entering the body. It's a different part of the mind that has that depth perception and naming of objects out there, birds, sea, ocean, people, etc. But the truth is the immediacy of experiences, light is entering the body, sound vibrations are entering the body, fragrances and flavors and sensations are already the body, and thoughts aren't out there. And the Buddha put it this way, in this fathom-long body, the entire universe arises, and the cause of the universe is seen, and the cessation of the universe is understood, and the path to the cessation of the universe, which is the deepest understanding, realization, and peace, is known. Just right here. Mao, for example, the Polynesian navigator, for him the stars weren't out there. He experienced the stars in the dome of the sky that was internalized in his own mind. So what he'd read in the cycle of stars, which, like the sun and moon, also rise and set over the horizon in different scales and cycles and so forth, he would know that. He would know where he was anywhere in the 25 million kilometer expanse of Polynesian Triangle. That's what we're learning to do, is how to read carefully everything going on in the body. The subtlest emotion and the strongest emotion can be held with metta or compassion, you know, or joy in this body. And the sense of it all happening to us from out there, going out there, being out there disappears. Inside and outside disappears. The metta is a foundation for the other Brahma Viharas that co-arise with it. If we understand metta, then we understand how, when we experience pain or hurt, suffering of any kind, that tenderness and openness, sensitivity of the heart responds with care. And if it's anything else, if it's sorrow, grief, fear, pity, it's not true compassion. It's something else we need to understand. It's not true compassion. And the same open, tender, soft, and sensitive heart of metta, when it touches wherever there's beauty and happiness, fulfillment in the world, in someone else, people we love, in our own life, that natural response of the heart is celebratory, is this empathetic joy, appreciation. Definitely something not taught us in the first grade or the last grade. We're not taught to appreciate. We're taught to compete and compare and measure and analyze and do everything but appreciate. It's this appreciative joy, bringing that back, because it's a natural state. It's a quality of the heart. These four qualities are the heart. It's a beautiful thing. And metta, in the moments of its full development, in a perfect metta moment, is just like pure balance, equanimity. It's the equanimity that keeps, that sustains that balance. And it's the connection and relational nature of metta that allows for the equanimity. Upekā means to look upon or look over, not look away from. So that shows us how equanimity is a very connective quality of heart. It's an emotion. It's not shutting down. It's not indifference. That's called its near enemy. It's not a disconnect. It's a powerful connect to look upon. So here we see how they play and they work as one. And then by being practiced here, because that's what we're doing, the purpose of our practice is for our own heart's sake, to open our own heart and to bring our own heart back to its natural state. We're not doing other people here, you know. Yeah, we're calling up good metta subjects to get it going, but it's not about that tree or that elder or that metta or compassion subject. It's about our heart. when practice, when we've done this intensive protective practice for our own sake, when then the result is it just spills out into the world by itself, by nature. And when we leave, through our thoughts, through the vehicle or the doorway of our thoughts and our speech and our action, it affects everybody and everything all the time, either in its presence or absence. So we're noticing when it's present and when it's absent. We're learning how to be patient when it's not present. And what do we fill the space with? Nothing. We're just okay. Metta isn't here. Metta's not home right now. And if you have an anchor, that's good. You can anchor in the body or the chest, you know. Feel whatever sensations are there, or hardness or whatever. Or we don't need a support. It can just be with the mind itself, the presence or absence of metta with the mind. If it's absent, well, what is there? You know, dissociation or discursive thought, we notice that. And usually we just remember, oh yeah, I'm practicing metta. That may not bring the metta back in that moment, but it reminds us of what we're doing here and what the intention is. And by tomorrow, the next day, it's more likely than not to bring back even just a few metta moments, connective moments. Remember, metta does not need to feel any certain way. Metta isn't this sudden, you know, volcano of blissful, lovely, bright, showering, sparkly experience, or a waterfall of coolness and, you know, good vibrations. That comes more from concentration. Metta is just even, it's just connective, it's relational. We see ourselves in each other and others in ourselves. You know, it's like it's this bond of humanity. It's very simple in that way. It's opposite, as I said, of any fear and ill will and anger. When we need to, when we're stuck there, to invite metta up to come forward, the opposite just disappears. Metta is way more powerful than what's called the far enemy. Irritation, annoyance, ill will, anger, aggression, violence, war. The what's called the near enemy, we also need to understand. We need to understand what looks like or what can be a masquerade of metta. It isn't the real thing. Like conditional. Metta is unconditional love. So even the slightest little hint or urge that we get something back, an acknowledgement, you know, thank you, or wow, you're so loving, or, you know, or comes back in the way of pleasant sensations or expectation or having our needs met. Those are all other kinds of affection. And we want to understand them, and we want to see many of them as normal and natural in our life and relations. We just don't want to mistake love with even the slightest attachment or wanting, desire, to think that that's the unconditional love of metta. So we learn about the near and the far, so-called near and far enemies. Then when there is a real pure moment of metta, there's no mistaking it. You know, we're there. We're being that. There's just the absence of its any possessiveness or self-referencing, that it's mine, I'm sending it to you, I'm wondering if that person at home, when Michelle and I would teach people at the 3-month retreats in Massachusetts, metta, you know, and they'd be doing this after 6 or 7 weeks, and they'd slip off a little bit, you know, and go into what we call yogi mind, where a molehill becomes a mountain, and they admit to us later, you know, I was feeling so much metta for so-and-so back home. I went downstairs to the payphone in those days. You know, there was no cell phones to sneak around. You had to go down and sneak around and get coins out, you know, and drop the quarters in. So I called home to see if they were feeling any metta, and they weren't. Is this working? You know? That's not why we do the metta here. We're doing it for the opening and the softening, and how to understand what that the abiding is the receiving, and the abiding, it is at the same time sending. We don't have to imagine. You know, you can do that sometimes if it feels effortless, but we don't need to do that later as that early faith becomes confidence, trust. Just know it. We just know in that abiding that every particle, every cell, every atom of the body is receiving and sending as it receives. Metta is like a mirror. Another short poem from A.R. Ammons. He lived from 1926 to 2001. I found a weed that had a mirror in it, and that mirror looked in at a mirror in me that had a weed in it. So simple. Michelle mentioned that we're doing this practice, that meditation, the Pali word for it is bhavana. So we're doing metta bhavana. And the root of Sanskrit, root of bhavana, is the word to be. So it means to bring forth, to bring into being. Metta bhavana is to bring forth beauty. Bhavana by itself bring forth all the beautiful states. An important critical sea change for me, doing a practice, long-term practice with Upandita, and I found my mind continually going into this sort of story, where I was feeling, you know, anger and shame and fear and going back, being present again. I can't remember if it being was it mindfulness or metta, but either way, it just kept going off, coming back and going off. And I reported that to Upandita, and he said, side by side with the discursive mind, the concentration and wisdom or metta develop. I didn't need to ask anymore. I knew exactly what he meant. That every time we're lost, maybe first 10, 20 minutes, you know, come back a few moments, we're present with our metta, anchored here, anchored with our easy metta subject, and then off again, you know, back and forth and back and forth. And it was so relieving to get that profound nugget of a teaching. I came back to sit, and the story just it lost its wind, you know? Like the wind went out of the sail and like the story dropped. And then, so there were those emotions, like just saw the emotions, but they were empty of any story. So I could just see and understand the fear and shame and anger, and this would drop away as I'd call up the mindfulness, you know, or the metta, this fall away. I would like you to remember that side by side, the image, the truth of it. One moment of mindfulness is more powerful than like a million moments of distraction, discursive thought. In the Dhammapada, this book of short teachings collected from the canon, the Pali canon, the many teachings of the Buddha, the Buddha says, better it is to live one day in mindfulness than 100 years in heedlessness. Michelle mentioned the first night. You know, so take that scale. And just one moment of mindfulness is better than hundreds of thousands or millions of moments of no mindfulness. It just has so much greater power. And that gave me energy. It changed my practice for, you know, that was like 30 years ago. And it's just, okay, so the mind goes off. But so quickly, so powerfully, does it bend back to the moment our mind inclines to be still, like the sea desolation sound was today. The mind inclines that way. If left alone, it just becomes still like water and clear, reflecting what's true. The horizon, the sky, the clouds. So we're learning to leave it alone. That's what it means, doing nothing with full commitment. Leave it alone and we'll see unconditional love and the caring nature of compassion, the joy of happiness and the great wide mind balance of equanimity. When I continue this talk, I'll talk about how we use these practices to stabilize in the face of distraction and what distractions are. You know, how some of them, as we've been saying, were really crucial plates of armor covering our chest when we felt manipulative or intrusive love or controlling love or overwhelming other emotions, experiences. Didn't know what to do with it. So learning to close that way. And how we can now actually replace that heavy, heavy unconscious armor with really conscious boundaries, conscious armor. And what is that? The four Brahma-viharas. They become more powerful than the shield of anger, aversion, or intellectualization, or numbing out. Shutting down, you know, equanimity and compassion and like tough love, fierce compassion, they're all the equivalent of their negative states, but they're born of wisdom, equivalent in power, in fact, greater in power than the negative similarities. But the force field of it is born of care and understanding. Like the end with a couple of, this is how I think of the Brahma-viharas. This is a poem by Anna Swier, a Polish woman who lived from 1909, 1984. She lived through the Second World War and witnessed and was herself a victim in concentration camps. Survive that. It's called Priceless Gifts. An empty day without events. And that is why it grew immense, a space, and suddenly happiness of being entered me. I heard in my heartbeat the birth of time and each instant of life, one after the other, came rushing in like priceless gifts. Her other poem's called A Double Rapture. She also wrote this very beautiful, eloquent book about the female body over the changing stages of life, called Talking to My Body. But this short poem's called A Double Rapture. Because there is no me, and because I feel how much there is no me. Let's sit for a moment.